Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Rod Eaton from TC Atlantic. Hello, this is Tom Campbell. Today is October 3rd, 2015, and we're talking with Rod Eaton from TC Atlantic. Rod, could you give us your full name, your date of birth, and hometown, please?
My full name is Rodney Einer, after my grandfather, Eaton. I was born in January of 1944 in Minneapolis.
What was the date on that?
January 11th, 1944.
What year did you graduate and what school did you go to?
I graduated high school in 1962 from Robbinsdale High School.
And what's your earliest memory of you wanting to be a drummer?
That's a really good question. When I was in grade school, fifth grade, I think, I wanted to be in the band, and I decided I wanted to play trombone. And I think I stuck that out for about 3 months. And leaving trombone was a mutual decision between the band director and me. So he basically said he didn't think I had much musical talent. And then I decided that I wanted to play the drums. You start out with sticks and a little practice pad, a little rubber pad. And I played with that for a while. Somewhere along the line, I started taking some lessons from a guy named Elliot Fine, who was a drummer with the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra. I graduated to a small set of drums that my parents were kind enough to buy me, given my early failure on trombone. And I stuck with that. The way that you practiced drums by yourself was to play with records in the basement, turning the phonograph up as loud as it would go, and then drumming with it. And there was an album that I bought somewhere in junior high called Music Minus One. They produced those with a big band minus a particular instrument. So mine was minus the drummer. And it actually came with drum charts for every cut on it. It was big band jazz. And so you'd sit down there and listen to that at full volume and try to play along with it. There were a couple of really good musicians in my neighborhood. A friend of mine right down the street from me was a monster keyboard guy, really an excellent keyboardist, piano and organ. His name was Tom Slobodzian. Tom and I played together. He was a jazz head too. And so through high school, he and I played for a variety of things with a couple of other people, like school assemblies and some dances and parties. And occasionally we'd get into a little more rock and roll kind of thing. But nobody really sang, and so you'd shout out the words to Don't You Just Know It or something, trying to shout over your own band. After I graduated from high school, I went to the university. I was in the marching band and the concert band, and I was in a class one day in the fall, my freshman year, with a friend of mine from high school who knew the Underbeats somehow, said they were looking for a drummer and put me together with them. And that's how I got involved with the Underbeats. So that's the long answer to your question about getting involved with drums and music.
So you joined the Underbeats in what year?
1963.
And how long did you stay with the Underbeats?
Till late in 1965.
And at that time period, what kind of drum set were you using?
I think I had gone from a Ludwig set to a Rogers set.
So you played both for the Underbeats?
Yeah.
And you're on a number of the Underbeats 45s that were recorded in the early time period, 64, 65. What did you do when you left the Underbeats?
I think for a really short time I played with a group called the Lancers.
What can you tell us about the Lancers?
R&B, pretty good group. I don't know what happened to their drummer. It seems like every drummer I replaced had been drafted, so he was probably drafted too. It's like the joke in Spinal Tap, except instead of these guys exploding, they all got drafted, I guess.
Now that was Jerry Francis and his group over on the St. Paul side of town.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And I played a few gigs with them. Like I said, it was very R&B. A lot of fun, good little group. And then somebody told me that TC Atlantic was looking for a drummer. I'd only heard them play for a short time the day of the Beatles concert. They were playing in the concourse around the stadium.
Okay, we know the date on that. That was August 21st, 1965.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the very first time you saw the band.
Yeah, and I think it might have been the only time I had seen them prior to joining them.
Can you tell us if Freddie and the guys in the band, TC Atlantic, were in a band prior to TC Atlantic?
As far as I can remember, and from what I've learned looking at old interviews, they formed their group in high school and stayed together right out of high school. But I think originally they called themselves the Chessmen. Then they hit on the name TC Atlantics with an S. Forever, you know, there was the joke about where that name came from. Freddie said everybody else was named after cars, the Ivanis and the, you know, the Firebirds and the Thunderbirds and everything. They were looking for something that was more unique. So they called themselves after an ocean and then put TC in front of it. And everybody always asked what that stood for, and we would always say it doesn't stand for anything, but I think it did stand for Twin Cities. At some point, the S got dropped very early, so it just became TC Atlantic.
And who would have been in the band, and who played what in the Chessmen?
Freddie Freeman on keyboard, Bob Wellesley guitar, Joe Cannon bass, and Dan Nelson was the original drummer.
And Freddie did all the lead vocals?
Freddie did lead vocal.
Did anybody do backing vocals?
Or? Bob and Joe always did backup then, and I don't know about Dan.
Okay. So at some point, Dan leaves the band, possibly was drafted, is that?
I think Dan was drafted, mm-hmm.
And that's when you heard about them looking for a band?
Yep. That would have been late 1965 that I heard that they were looking for a drummer.
Did you have to audition?
You know, I don't remember. I think I probably met them. We usually rehearsed in Freddie's basement in St. Paul Park or Cottage Grove in that area someplace. Ran through things with them. They were already a pretty busy band, so I probably had to learn most stuff on stage with them.
What kind of music was TC Atlantic doing at the time you joined?
They had kind of an eclectic songbook at the time, mostly covers of old stuff. But it was a mix of things like Rockin' Robin, you know, some kind of novelty things from the earlier 60s. They played some R&B material, a lot of stuff. It was a very danceable group. And I think the thing that always characterized them was there was a sense of fun about listening to the band.
Do you remember your first live job with TC Atlantic?
I don't remember the first one, but I remember some of the first ones. They had recorded a song just before I joined called I Love You So, Little Girl. That was written by two guys, Peter Steinberg and Harley Toberman, and it was on the Aesop label. It was sort of a ballad, a bubblegummy ballad song. The rhythm in it had clinking sound, percussive clinking, that on stage I did by clicking two Coke bottles together that I had to carry around with me. I remember one night playing the song and the bottles broke in my hands as I was playing it. And after that, I think we might have stopped playing that song. Peter Steinberg was an interesting guy. And in the studio, he was always looking for a sound that was unique and different. So he'd drag in every goddamn thing to hit with something. There was a 3-foot length railroad track in there that he hit with a board or something for a song. The Coke bottles, you know, made an interesting sound. It was kind of a musical sound. And it was on the 2 and 4, you know, like a hi-hat kick. But I guess it wasn't intended to be played live with the Coke bottles.
I'm looking at that 45, I Love You So, Little Girl, and I see the flip side is Once Upon a Melody.
Yep.
Did you do that song, too?
We did that song, too. It was more up-tempo. The band never, I don't think the band liked either one of those songs very much. We played them for a while to reinforce the radio play. But as I remember it, as soon as we could, we stopped playing those songs.
So they were on the radio, or one of them was?
I think I Love You So, Little Girl got some airplay.
Now, when you talk about Pete Steinberg, of course, you're referring to Dove Recording Studio.
Mm-hmm.
Where was Dove located exactly?
Originally, Dove was in St. Louis Park. They had a little studio. Their joke was the very first session they ever did, which was a song called The Crusher, turned out to be kind of a big hit on the radio.
By the Novas.
The studio was owned by two people, basically. Daryl Arvidson, who was the engineer and an electric electronic genius. He built virtually the whole studio. And Don Peterson. Don was more of a silent partner. Arv always claimed that he hated rock and roll. You know, to have to record The Crusher as your first song must have been crushing to his soul, too. But shortly after that, the studio moved to 93rd and James in Bloomington, and they had a much bigger facility there. It was originally a standard two-track studio. Two tracks then was kind of industry standard. K-Bank and all the studios were two-track studios. And, you know, without getting into too much detail, two tracks limit what you can do recording, because to overdub, you have to bounce from one tape machine to another. And when you do that, the sound quickly degrades, starts to fall apart. Not too long after the studio moved to Bloomington, they got the first four-channel recorder in the upper Midwest, an Ampex four-track machine. That recorded on half-inch tape. And that allowed you to overdub all on one tape. You could record something on two tracks, like the band and vocals, and then you'd have two channels left to go back and add things to. So Dove became the most sophisticated studio in the upper Northwest for a little while, until K-Bank got, I think, an eight-track machine. The tracks escalated very quickly after that, from 8 and then to 16, and, you know, it just sort of exploded. But for a while, Dove was pretty sophisticated.
Now, you mentioned Don Peterson, and talking to you earlier about him, you had an interesting story about a certain organ he had in his home basement.
Yeah, Don had a full-size theater organ in his basement. They bought it, he and his father bought it out of a theater somewhere. They literally had a pit dug next to their basement to accommodate the long 32-foot pipes that organ had. The console was in the basement family room. There were pipes next to the house. There were smaller pipes in the basement behind the console. And what makes a theater organ unique is that it has percussion attached to it, drums and sometimes xylophones and all sorts of interesting percussion. And that was scattered all over, bass drum, snare drum. So when they played the organ, the whole house became the sounding chamber. It was really remarkable.
Where was the house located?
In St. Louis Park, right off of Highway 100.
What did the neighbors think?
I never asked the neighbors what they thought. Don wasn't a great organist, but his father, as I remember, was pretty good. And so maybe they all appreciated it. I don't know. Don was a movie projectionist, also very good with electronics. He could repair and rebuild things. I don't know where he and Arvidsson met. But Don always sort of had a job and did things, and Arv ran the studio.
So back to TC Atlantic, and right after you joined, what were some of the clubs the band was playing at when you joined?
You know, the ones I can remember locally would have been Bobby's, Mr. Lucky's, which became Magoo's, I think. Every armory, Legion Hall, big enough to hold 300 people, became a dance club. In those days, in the middle 60s, it was possible for a popular band like TC Atlantic to work literally every night of the week all summer long. And not unusual to play 8 or 9 times a week, because you'd stick in an afternoon job or a late night job somewhere. But the band traveled around all of Minnesota. We got into parts of Iowa, the Dakotas, Wisconsin, mostly playing teen things. Although when you got into Wisconsin and Iowa, you were sometimes playing for an older crowd too.
Was the band booked at this time by a professional booking agent?
We were booked through Central Booking, which was Bill Deal and Dick Shapiro. Mostly Dick. Bill was sort of the silent partner in that organization. And I don't remember another agency booking us. I think we were always booked by Central Booking.
And I assume you played ballrooms as well?
Yep. We played the Bel Ray. We played the Prom Ballroom. We played the Blue Note Ballroom down in southwestern Minnesota.
Winstead,
Minnesota.
How about the Marigold?
Played the Marigold. And what was the ballroom over, like in Mendota, across the Mendota Bridge? There was a ballroom over there that was mostly, they did an old-time
Schlieff's Little City.
Schlieff's Little City, yeah.
Okay, so your very first 45 that you recorded with TC Atlantic would have been which two songs?
Mona, backed with My Babe, and they came out on the B-sharp label.
And Mona is a cover song originally done by who?
Bo Diddley.
And what about My Babe?
I think that was done by Little Walter, but I think it was written by Willie Dixon.
Okay, and this comes out on the B-sharp label. Do you get any airplay?
We got a lot of airplay on Mona, a ton of airplay. Things were way different in radio back then, Top 40 radio, because stations would support local bands. And if you or the promoter would take a record out there, chances were really good they'd get it into their rotation. They didn't have playlists that came out of a national headquarters somewhere. Sometimes, you know, DJs on different stations like KDWB and WDGY would sort of compete with each other to promote a band the hardest. Bill Deal, of course, always had a vested interest in promoting bands since he was booking them too. But DJs on KDWB and, you know, DJs like Donald Martin would play local recordings heavily because the bands would sometimes stop in and talk to them on air. I think Donald Martin had a late night show because I remember stopping at their station, coming home from jobs with the band, and we'd sit in the studio and talk with him while he was on the air. It was a lot of fun.
I heard he did something kind of strange one night.
Well, I don't like to point fingers, but it seems to me that one night he was playing with a gun in the studio, a handgun. Not so funny today, but as I recall, he shot the wall or shot the clock.
Well, he would have been alone at the studio at night, right?
Well, there was an engineer there in another room, yeah. But otherwise, pretty much alone. Mm-hmm.
So did Mona get played on both WDGY and
yes.
KDWB?
Yep. I don't remember how well it did on their top 40 charts, but it probably got into the top 15 or so.
And Steinberg is the producer?
I guess so, yeah. Steinberg was there for an awful lot of that stuff. Is his name on the label?
At the bottom.
Yeah. It is.
And it also says Candy Floss on...
As a producer. Candy Floss was Peter Steinberg's company.
Right. So, and again, Daryl would have been there doing the engineering for
yes,
this?
Yes, he would have. Yep, Arv. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall roughly how long you were in the studio to cut these two songs?
If it was more than 2 hours, I'd be very surprised. Tracks were laid down usually in a complete pass through the song. You didn't record 8 bars and then punch in the next 8 and punch in the next 8 or lay down rhythm and then come back and add guitar and so on. The whole band would play at one time, and often you'd play and sing at the same time. The trick in a recording studio is to isolate the sound of different instruments and voices. And the way that was often done is the drums would be in a room where they could be kind of isolated acoustically from the other people. And instead of using amplifiers, guitars were often plugged straight into the recording equipment. Everybody wore headphones to hear what was going on. And you'd go straight through the song. If you didn't like it, you'd go through it again. But these were songs that we'd been playing on stage for a while, so you knew them. You could usually get them recorded to everybody's satisfaction in 1 or 2 takes.